The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we're going to read all of the latest news from the Triangle Business Journal, starting off with the first headline. American Airlines layoffs, furloughs could hit 2,500 plus jobs in North Carolina, with hundreds in Triangle. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. American Airlines has disclosed more than 2,500 expected furloughs and layoffs in North Carolina, including more than 700 in Wake County, as the airline plans for up to 25,000 job reductions across the country. In a disclosure filed with the North Carolina Department of Commerce, the airline confirmed 369 jobs impacted at Raleigh-Durham International Airport and an additional 370 tied to an address on Gregson Drive in Cary. Additional cuts were reported in Charlotte and Winston-Salem. American Airlines didn't immediately respond to a request for comment Friday. The airline industry has been devastated by the pandemic as most travel has stalled. And after a slight pickup in travel in May and June, the growing number of COVID-19 cases across the country could lead to another setback. In Americans' notice to North Carolina, which is dated July 15 and signed by Patrick O'Keefe, senior vice president, American Airlines blames unforeseeable circumstances surrounding COVID-19. The notice says 74 of the cuts are expected to be permanent, with an additional 2,474 across the state classified as furloughs, according to the notice. The layoffs and furloughs are scheduled to begin on October 1. The furloughs are expected to be temporary, the notice reads, adding that it is our sincere hope that this number decreases based on factors such as additional voluntary leaves of absences and voluntary early outs or changes in the demand environment. In Charlotte, where American Airlines Group Incorporated ranks as the sixth largest employer, 1,479 employees at four locations could be impacted, the Charlotte Business Journal reported. The disclosure does not come as a surprise. This week, American Airlines leadership said that the firm would be sending out 25,000 WARN notices across its operation. We hate taking this step as we know the impact it has on our hardworking team members, CEO Doug Parker and President Robert Isom said in a letter to employees. The company had already confirmed plans to close its RDU flight attendant base, transitioning it to a satellite location. Across the company, flight attendants will be the hardest hit work group as 9,950 will receive notices. That represents 37% of all American flight attendants. Other work groups that will receive notices across the company include 2,500 pilots, 3,200 mechanics, 4,500 employees in fleet service, and another 2,900 in passenger service. Advance Auto Parts CEO talks shifting vision for North Hills HQ. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. As Advance Auto Parts readies to move into its new North Hills headquarters, a global pandemic could change the way the Fortune 500 firm works. That's according to CEO Tom Greco, who toured his new digs Thursday. Greco says the company is moving ahead full throttle with the new headquarters, despite the fact that the vast majority of the Raleigh operation is currently working from home. The tower, which looms over Interstate 440, could start housing employees near the first of the year. That is, if the pandemic situation allows its occupancy. Greco said his team is already planning how it can move forward in a new space safely. We're going to move back into the office in a way that's safe for our people, and that may mean not everybody is there 5 days a week, he said. We're looking at which roles can be effectively done remotely. And there are challenges. The headquarters was designed to foster person-to-person relationships. Its open environment was specifically conceptualized for collaboration, So the question is, how to create the environment he's envisioning in the new normal of COVID-19? Greco said he still doesn't have all the answers. His team is working on its floor plan to ensure desks are adequately spaced apart and having conversations with the builder about enhanced airflow systems. Greco said the timing, at least for the headquarters build-out, was lucky. If we had all moved back in January, that would have been challenging, he said. As it's a new build, there's still some flexibility surrounding what the space will look like. Greco said his vision for the space is the same, a place to attract millennial talent. I'm excited, he said. I think we're going to be able to attract very high caliber set of team members into that building. As for the greater COVID-19 crisis, Advance Auto Parts has pushed through without COVID-related furloughs, Greco said. That was a difficult decision, he notes. There was a pressure for us to do it, but we just felt like it was early. We didn't want to knee-jerk react to it, and things changed quickly. Triangle's wealthiest zip codes land hundreds of PPP loans for $150,000 or more. This article is written by David Pertel and Dathan Kazik. The Triangle's wealthiest zip codes had hundreds of businesses approved for Paycheck Protection Program loans of $150,000 or more. A Business Journal's analysis of data released by the U.S. Small Business Administration looked at 50 zip codes across the Triangle from Raleigh to Chapel Hill and Durham and included nearly 3,500 approved loans. Of that total, the region's top 10 wealthiest zip codes by median household income tallied 461 loans, 13% of the total. Among the top 10 wealthiest zip codes, the area in Southeast Cary around Lockmere Golf Club, the 27518 zip code with a median household income of $106,800, was approved for the most loans, 83 in all. The zip code is the fifth wealthiest in the Triangle, according to census data. The majority of the area's loans were approved for between $150,000 and $350,000, while 10 were for $1 million or more, including an approved loan amount of for between $5 million and $10 million to a dental practice, Rick O'Bean and Associates, according to SBA data. The geographic snapshot was made available after the SBA released data July 6 on the $660 billion PPP program, which is meant to help businesses keep workers on the payroll during the economic downturn of the pandemic. The SBA data did not specify exact loan amounts, instead breaking the amounts into brackets. The data shows approved amounts for loans and doesn't necessarily mean that was the amount a business received. Businesses in the 27519 zip code in West Cary, the region's wealthiest, were approved for 40 PPP loans. All of the loans were for between $150,000 and $1 million. The median household income in the 27519 zip code is $130,300. For comparison, the second wealthiest area in the Triangle, the 27571 zip code for Rollsville, saw just five PPP loans, all for between $150,000 and $350,000. The area's median household income is $112,000, and its population was just 6,600 in 2018, according to census data. The 27608 zip code, the wealthiest in Raleigh with median household income of nearly $108,000, saw 45 PPP loans. It is the fourth wealthiest zip code in the Triangle. Of the 50 zip codes in the analysis, 14 each saw more than 100 businesses approved for PPP loans. The most, 216 total loans, were for businesses in the 27609 zip code, which surrounds North Hills in Raleigh. The area saw 16 loans with approved amounts for between $2 million and $5 million, but most 116 loans were for between $150,000 and $350,000. National Builder plots 200-plus homes across two Triangle communities. And this article is written by Caleb Harshberger. A home-building giant has plans to bring hundreds of new homes to the Triangle across two communities in the company's latest expansion in the region. Earlier this month, Arizona-based Meritage Homes closed on two assemblages in the Triangle with plans to build two communities, Brighton Station in Durham and South and Main in Fuquay Varina. Altogether, the developments will feature 223 homes across 18 and 29 acres, respectively. Brighton Station. In Durham, Brighton Station will feature 70 single-family homes geared toward a more affordable price point. The community is situated on 18 acres at 3840 Andrew Avenue near Bethesda Park, off Highway 70 southeast of the city, and down the road from a collection of retailers. Meritage closed on the property earlier this year for $1.75 million. Brighton Station will offer affordable single-family homes with clear pricing and a simpler home buying process with Meritage Homes' high standard for quality construction and energy efficiency built into each home, said Raleigh Division President Rick Rojas. Brighton Station will be near our vibrant Ellis Crossing community and allows us to build on our recent success in the thriving city of Durham, he says. Buyers will have the option to choose from six home layouts with sizes ranging from 1,600 to 2,700 square feet. South and Main. In Fuquay Varina, South and Main will feature 153 new single-family homes and townhomes. The community is situated on 29 acres at 1105 Main Street in south of downtown. Meritage bought the property for $1.45 million last month. South and Main will feature two-story, quick-move-in single-family homes and townhomes with convenient access to downtown shopping and dining, as well as local schools, offering an excellent quality of life for our home buyers, Rojas said. Buyers will have the option to choose from five layouts with home sizes ranging from 1,700 to 2,100 square feet. According to data for 2018, Meritage Homes is the 10th largest home builder in the Triangle, as ranked by dollar volume of Triangle contracts closed that year. Meritage closed on $111.5 million worth of contracts in 2018, representing 277 homes built with an average price of $402,529. Last year, Meritage Homes filed plans for a nearly 600-home community on 165 acres in Garner. Investors for Durham startup bet $10.8 million that people will eat wood. And this article is written by Lauren Onasorge. Investors are taking a $10.8 million bet that people will line up to eat what a Durham company is offering, wood. Arbiome, spelled A-R-B-I-O-M, a company trying to turn wood into a meat-like protein, disclosed the fundraise, a mix of equity and warrants, in a securities filing Wednesday. The firm, which started out as a French contract research organization before transitioning to protein development, did not immediately return a request to comment on the raise. But last month, the company announced that it had completed a proof-of-concept study in partnership with a leading extrusion R&D organization to evaluate its protein in human food applications. The study, according to what Arbiome said in a press release at the time, found its protein called Silpro could successfully replace ingredients typically found in meat replacements such as soy and wheat gluten without compromising taste or product quality. The results demonstrate the potential for Silpro to replace ingredients that play a functional role but may have restrictions due to allergen concerns, the release said. Previously, Arbiome had been exploring ways the protein could be used for livestock feed. It's not clear who's backing Arbiome this time around, but the filing lists French venture capitalist Sharam Bekarat as a director. It appears to be the first U.S. raise for the company, which previously received two grants from the European Union, totaling more than $16 million. The company, according to the North Carolina Secretary of State's office, registered to do business in North Carolina in 2015. And last year, Ricardo Ekme, president, vice president of nutrition, told the Triangle Business Journal the ultimate plan was to build a manufacturing facility in the U.S. Think retail is dead? Don't tell the man behind this Pittsburgh project. And that's the headline in an article written by Caleb Harshberger. A property owner with nearly a whole town block in downtown Pittsburgh has plans to transform the area into a retail and dining destination. Greg Stafford has announced plans for SoCo in the heart of downtown Pittsburgh. The project is situated at West Street and Sanford Road facing the historic courthouse. The name SoCo stands for South of the Courthouse. Stafford's plan comes in three parts, not necessarily to be done in the following order. Crews will demolish a thrift store on the corner to make way for a new outdoor plaza that will allow for outdoor dining year-round, or at least as long as weather permits. A string of buildings behind that site will see new life with extensive interior and exterior renovations. This includes a space that is currently home to the Pittsburgh Roadhouse restaurant, which plans to vacate that space this year. and an aging building to the south of those sites will be demolished and replaced by a new two-story restaurant, Space Complete, with rooftop dining. Altogether, the project calls for around 20,000 square feet of mixed-use retail and dining space. The site is entitled, though site plans still need approval from the town. Stafford said he hopes to be able to break ground by the start of next year, and in the meantime, he is looking for the right businesses to attract customers to the new spot. "We're looking for two anchor tenants, and we'll begin the project the moment one of those people signs up," Stafford said. "For a project like this, you're looking for as much attitude as it is acumen, because we need somebody who will bring people to that corner in downtown Pittsburgh." The architect on the project, Taylor Hobbs, owner of Hobbs Architects, said the new plan will bring a significant transformation to the Chatham County town. "It's the redevelopment of really a major portion of downtown Pittsburgh," Hobbs said. "He's got about a block that he owns, which is pretty rare. As a percentage of downtown, that is pretty big." Stafford said he plans to stay on with the project long term and to do what it will take to make it succeed, even if that means waiting a bit to see a profit. "It's a long, long-term project. You can't refurbish a downtown area and charge the rents that'll make it pay for itself early," Stafford said. "It's a long-term labor of love." Raleigh-based Lynch Mikens is the structural engineer on the project. Durham-based Emerson Land Design is the landscape architect. And Raleigh-based Maple Engineering is providing plumbing, mechanical, and electrical engineering services. It's not the only big project in the works for Pittsburgh. Despite the pandemic, work continues on the massive Chatham Park development just north of town. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. The headline, "Rising Inequality, Why Black Businesses Miss Out on Billions in North Carolina Contracts." Every year, the state of North Carolina collects billions in taxes on its diverse population of residents and businesses. Much of that funding is used to finance the operation of state agencies, including billions in annual construction and purchasing that flow to vendors. But minority-owned businesses fail to receive their fair share of that work each year, and the issue continues despite well-documented disparities, a long list of legal orders, and a state office dedicated to fighting against it. In fact, according to a Triangle Business Journal analysis, these historically underutilized businesses, or hubs, have lost out on nearly $3 billion in contract opportunities in the last two decades. That figure represents an estimate based on the minimum threshold the state has had in place since 1999 for hub participation in state spending. "The system itself is not set up to do business with black people," said Cornelius Lambert, the CEO of Greensboro-based C2 Contractors and chairman of the Governor's Advisory Council on Historically Underutilized Businesses. "It's very obvious that we have the financials to do and work at any level, but we just don't get the same opportunity," he says. The numbers are even more stark when it comes to African Americans, since hub numbers include companies run by white females and other minority groups. In fiscal 2019, for example, only 17% of hub spending went to black-owned firms. The issue dates back two decades when a disparity study commissioned by the state in 1999 said at least 10% of state purchasing should go to hubs. But the state has never achieved it. To the contrary, it has steadily moved further away from that goal as state spending increased by billions. And while North Carolina officials and hub owners all agree the state has seen successful progress in some areas of spending, such as construction, it has seen a decrease in the exponentially larger so-called goods and services category of state spending. Critics say the reason behind the failure is an unwillingness to demand state agencies perform to the letter of the law. Current and former state officials say simple legislation regarding contract bidding could change the numbers overnight, but that legislation has never materialized. "Minority and women-owned businesses are the lifelines in their communities. They are the engines that drive economic vitality in our communities," said Tammy Hall, director of the Office for Historically Underutilized Businesses, part of the North Carolina Department of Administration. "When we see ourselves investing in these businesses, that's when you will start to see your communities thriving. You'll see better schools. You'll start to see infrastructure projects increasing." Two decades of failure. On April 20, 1999, Governor Jim Hunt signed Executive Order No. 150, codifying an effort to increase the amount of state dollars contracted to minority-owned businesses, as well as creating the Hub Office and Advisory Council. Each agency should strive to increase the total amount of goods and services acquired by it from hub vendors, whether directly as principal contractors or indirectly as subcontractors or otherwise, the order states. It is expected that at least 8% by dollar amount of the state's purchase of goods and services during fiscal year 1999 to 2000 and at least 10% during fiscal year 2000 to 2001 will be derived from hub vendors. A hub is defined in North Carolina as a business that is 51% owned by a minority, Black, Hispanic, Asian American, or American Indian, a female, or a disabled disadvantaged individual. In identifying these companies, the state looks first at ethnicity, then gender, and then status, meaning a female hub is owned by a white woman and a disabled hub is owned by a white male. The expectation and objectives listed in the order made it less than 1 year, and the recommended 10% minimum threshold from a diversity study commissioned by the state the same year continues to go unachieved. According to the North Carolina Department of Administration's annual reports, the percent of goods and services spending that went to hubs in fiscal year 1999 to 2000 came to 9%, 1% higher than its goal for that year. But that 9% is the highest percentage the state has ever achieved. The following year, fiscal year 2000 to 2001, just 8.5% of the state's goods and services spent made it to hubs. And yet it is the second highest percentage received in any fiscal year since the executive order was signed. In the 19 fiscal years reported by the NCDOA since 1999, the percentage of goods and services going to hubs has decreased. In fiscal year 2018 to 2019, the percentage stood at just 5.2%, barely higher than the historic low of 4.8% in fiscal year 2015 to 2016. The difference between 5.2% and 10% at the scale of state spending is notable. The 5.2% that went to hubs in the state translates to about $367.2 million. The state spent a total of $7.04 billion that year. The difference between its actual spending for hubs and its 10% goal is an additional $337.4 million that never went to hub communities. But the failure to reach these numbers is not just calculations based on a 1999 idea. Since Hunt's order, Governors Mike Easley, Beverly Perdue, and Pat McCrory have signed their own executive orders reassuring the same language as Hunt, issuing aspirational goals of at least 10% and setting expectations that agencies endeavor to reach it. And most recently, Governor Roy Cooper's June 2020 Executive Order number 143, addressing the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on communities of color, includes language supporting the hub office, including allocating $500,000 to start a small business enterprise program. But despite two decades of work from the DOA office created to increase spending, the state's goal has gone unmet, a frustrating outcome for hub business owners, and especially for those of color who can struggle to get even their share of hub contracts. I clearly understand business, but no one can teach you how to do business as a Black business, said Lamberth of the barriers to obtaining these state contracts. For example, last year, 50% of total hub spending was received by white women-owned businesses, about 2.4% of the total goods and services spending. At the same time, Black businesses received just 16% of hub spending. And while the numbers have failed to reach the minimum goal for all hub businesses, Black businesses specifically are receiving far less than their representative share. Roughly 22% of the state's population is Black, yet Black businesses receive a fraction of that in state spending. The first year the state's annual reports broke down hub spending by specific races was fiscal year 2009 to 2010. In that year, of the more than $5.2 billion the state spent on goods and services plus construction, just $108 million went to Black-owned businesses, or just over 2%. Hubs overall collected about $435.8 million, meaning Black-owned businesses received 25% of that total. The numbers have not improved. In 2018 to 2019, Black businesses received a total of $80.4 million of the state's $7.5 billion spending, just over 1%. As a total percent of hub spending, which was $468 million, Black businesses received just 17%. Hub owners such as Lambert say businesses simply transferring ownership from a white male to a white female spouse has created an easy loophole. And Bridget Wall-Lennon, who guided the Hub office for its first 14 years of operation, said dealing with these so-called front women-owned businesses was a challenge. If you're already a white male company, you're participating in a pool of 90%, and now it's like you changed the paperwork so you can get in on the 10% too, she said. Building toward a goal. State spending reported by the DOA in relation to Hub participation is divided into two categories, construction and goods and services, which encompasses the vast range of material acquisitions and services that keep the state's operations moving. Although the state has failed to reach its 10% goal for goods and services, it has excelled in reaching the same goal for state construction contracts. During the 1999 to 2000 fiscal year, just 6.8% of the state's construction dollars went to hubs. The state reached 12% the next year and has steadily increased hub participation in construction. In the most recent year, hubs accounted for 20% of construction spending, down from a high of 33% seen in fiscal year 2017 to 2018. In fact, since issuing its 10% goal, the state has only failed to achieve it 1 year. Its fiscal year 2001 to 2002, when it registered at 9.3%. The next lowest was the following year at 12.5%. But critics note that success in the construction side of the state spending is of considerably smaller scale. We would be further along now because there's so many ways to do business under goods and services that you can't do in construction, Lambert said. In the most recent fiscal year, the state spent just $504 million in total. Hub's 20% cut amounted to just $100 million, compared to the more than $367 million gained in a 5% sliver of the state's $7 billion goods and services budget. Hall said the success in construction is a roadmap for goods and services. One of my high priorities has been working on the goods and services side to get more support and encouraging more of our vendors to do what we do on the construction side, and we're really good at it, she said. Driving construction success, Hall said, has been the state's willingness to break apart contracts so they are more manageable for hubs, which tend to be smaller and can handle maybe $200,000 and below type projects. One of the owners of a firm that has grown with hub contracts, Kristen Hess, a white woman who is the CEO of Raleigh-based HH Architecture, said she believes breaking up construction projects has been the reason that the state has been better at encouraging hub growth. There are not that many firms that can do all the drywall in a 225,000-square-foot building, she said. It's harder on the general contractor or the construction manager, but if you break up the packages and say, you're going to do the drywall on this end of the building and you're going to do the drywall on this side of the building or something like that, and you break up the packages, suddenly there's more opportunity. Some firms just aren't to that scale yet, and that's how they get scaled. Mandating participation. While breaking up contracts made them more manageable for hubs, officials say the real secret to success for the construction side of spending has been legislation mandating participation. While Lennon said one of the biggest challenges early was encouraging minority participation. At the time, the state was really big on low bid, she said. Sometimes it didn't matter how much outreach you did. If the hub wasn't the lowest bid, they just didn't get the bid. That, as well as a trend toward bundling certain contracts to fewer firms, created a situation in which many hubs were too small to service a proposed contract and much less able to do it for the low prices massive competitors could offer. But Wall-Lennon, like Hall, notes that breaking apart the contracts in construction and creating legislative mandates to include hub participation in the bidding process quickly led to progress obtaining hub participation, results they believe would be replicable on the goods and services side. Both Wall-Lennon and Hall say that specific legislative requirements for the goods and services side is necessary to improve hub participation. What we know is that when we had legislation that laid out the parameters for construction, we know that it worked, Hall said. Certainly, if we had the opportunity for legislation on the purchasing side, it would be of huge value to our program and to diversity and inclusion efforts in general. Asked why during her 14-year tenure she was unable to get specific legislation through on the goods and services side, Wall-Lennon pointed to the political climate and what the various administrations thought they could get through. We tried to get legislation for that, which, you know, you've kind of got to get buy-in from the administration, she said. I think there was a lot of pushback from the Division of Purchase and Contract for some reason, which never really made sense to me. Governor Cooper's office did not respond to multiple requests to comment on the issue. While Lennon is not the only person to mention the Purchase and Contract Office, regarding why contracts are not being broken up and why goods and services participation pales compared to construction, Lamberth blamed the Division of Purchase and Contract for being unwilling to push for more inclusion. Asked to respond, State Purchasing Officer Odessa McGlown, in a statement through a DOA representative, said, "The legislature has mandated a 10% goal for state construction projects and given the State Construction Office authority to enforce that goal, while the Purchase and Contract Office has not been given authority by the legislature to enforce a 10% goal for state purchase of other goods and services." The State of North Carolina's State Purchasing Office represents all agencies and vendors and strives to implement and execute policies under our authority that actively remove barriers within the procurement process to facilitate access and efficiency for all vendors, including hub vendors. We work to ensure the application of public procurement's basic tenets, equity, transparency, and accountability. Regardless of culpability, officials and business owners say breaking apart contracts and mandating a 10% goal is the only way to lead to a more equitable spending in goods and services. Break down your efforts, meaning don't make the procurement opportunity so large that only Office Depot can provide the solution for it, Lamberth said. But we're not committed. It is unfathomable. Hess said a mandatory requirement is the only way to ensure success. The most effective way is to mandate that there be participation, she said. People just don't seem to want to do it unless it's a requirement, which is sad, but it's the reality. Suddenly, when there's a requirement, whoa, how about that? We have diverse teams. Somebody figured out how to do it. Time to share. The Danielle Company, a Durham-based general contractor and construction management company that is wholly owned by African-American women, opened in 2006. President and CEO Gloria Sheely said it has relied on public contracts not just for roughly 60% of its business, but to scale and validate its work to grow its private industry work. She said hub access is something that needs to be expanded to give firms such as hers and the community her revenue supports a chance in an industry dominated by larger, less diverse companies. Unfortunately, the necessity still exists because the resources and the relationships are not readily available to the diverse firms. Clearly, if there were no barriers, there would not be a need for a hub office, she said. There's something systemic, and you can call it systemic racism, but it is systemic in the systems that exist that has created the barriers. Nobody likes to share. Well, get over yourself. You've got to share. Sheely is careful to note that just because the hub office practices supporting hub participation in public bidding to give them an opportunity, the companies that succeed still have to form the value of their work and sweat of their brows. She said breaking up the bubble of people getting comfortable doing businesses with the people they know is a necessary part of the stewardship of public funding. This creates a pathway of access. It's not a guarantee, Sheely said. You still have to do the work. You still have to bid competitively. You still have to win. The bottom line is you have to look at that as not the end-all, be-all. It is a point of access, a tool that you can take benefit from if you recognize the value of it. And now we turn to the biz section, written by Dane Huffman, managing editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The first headline: Building honoring UNC pioneer rises in Chapel Hill. A four-story office complex named for the first African-American woman to attend UNC Chapel Hill has been topped out as construction moves ahead at the historic Glen Lennox community in Chapel Hill. Work on The Gwendolyn, a 106,000-square-foot Class A office building at Glen Lennox, has reached its topping out, and developers plan to open the building in the first quarter of 2021. The Gwendolyn bears the name of Gwendolyn Harrison, who gained admission to the university's PhD program in Spanish before her acceptance was revoked in 1951, sparking a fight that resulted in university trustees reinstating her admission. The building is part of the first phase of Grubb Properties redevelopment of the Glen Lennox community and will join a new apartment complex and a host of new amenities. We are tremendously pleased to have reached the topping out milestone on schedule, said Joe Dye, Executive Vice President for Grub Properties. We are proud of the partnership we have forged with the town of Chapel Hill over the years and have diligently worked to ensure this building, as well as the entire redevelopment of Glen Lennox, fits the character and economic development needs of this community. Harrison later taught at Johnson C. Smith University and died in 2017 at the age of 91. Car sales start to recover in North Carolina. You'd think a pandemic would finally make it easier to register a car at the NC Division of Motor Vehicles, but the lines are longer than you think. Car sales plummeted across the nation when the pandemic hit. In the U.S., there were almost 1.6 million new vehicles sold in March 2019, a number that dropped to 912,800 in March 2020, according to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. But in June, that number was back to 1.17 million. North Carolina is following a similar pattern. Last year, the state issued 188,252 new registrations, which would include new and used cars, in April, a number that fell to 119,275 this April. That number was back up to 164,128 in May, according to DMV officials. Guess who has hired an advertising agency? A worldwide ad agency that created some of the country's most iconic ads and even employed Dr. Seuss has a new and unexpected client. Carrie's SaaS has named McGann Worldwide its global brand partner to reintroduce SaaS to the world. For more than 40 years, we have let the power of our analytics and AI solutions speak for themselves through the incredible work of our customers around the world, said Jennifer Chase, Senior Vice President and Head of Marketing at SaaS. As we look toward a future of delivering analytics everywhere for everyone, it's the right time to tell our own story in a bold way. McCann created the famous It's the Real Thing ads for Coca-Cola and Put a Tiger in Your Tank for Esso. The company once employed Theodore Seuss Geisel of Dr. Seuss fame. Still, the move is a surprise. Michael Hubbard, the CEO at Media 2 Interactive, posted on LinkedIn, "I'll admit it, I'm shocked. SaaS finally hired an ad agency. I've never known them to do anything outsourced before. I think it's great and hope they have some great success." Tractor dealer makes a big donation to hospital. A tractor dealer based in Wendell has made a big donation of masks to UNC Rex Healthcare. Coyote Tractor, a division of Daedong USA, donated 10,000 N95 masks to the hospital, plus a four-wheel vehicle. "We're proud to support the healthcare workers risking their lives on the front line every day to care for North Carolinians throughout this pandemic," said Peter Dong Kyun Kim, president and CEO of the Coyote Tractor division. Sylvia Hackett, vice president of the Rex Healthcare Foundation, said the hospital is grateful for the help. Recent Duke grad comes up with an easy way to do a biography. The musical Hamilton asks, who tells your story? Now, the answer could be you. A recent Duke University graduate has founded Trido, spelled T-R-A-D-O, a voice-to-book technology firm that allows clients to create personalized family history books. Sophia Parvizi Wayne, working with Jacob Cohn and Max Stern, has clients answer specific questions and then record information onto an app. Trado's tech team does a transcription, and then professional writers turn it into a book. Wayne got the idea when her mother suffered from bladder cancer and the daughter wanted to tell her story. "The world is becoming so focused on technology that we are forgetting the importance of human experience," she said. Former Charlotte mayor pleads for leniency for Robin Hayes. A former mayor of Charlotte has become the latest to defend former NCGOP leader Robin Hayes, currently awaiting sentencing for lying to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Richard Vinroot, who unsuccessfully ran against Hayes for the Republican nomination for governor in 1996, wrote his friend a letter of support. "I believe Robin to be kind, thoughtful, and generous to friend and foe alike, and I like and respect him very much for those reasons," Vinroot wrote Judge Max Cogburn, July 13. "My hope is that Your Honor will take these good qualities into consideration when you render your judgment." Hayes pleaded guilty last year. Last month, his attorneys asked for leniency, noting his age in light of the COVID-19 situation in prisons. Hayes could face up to 6 months in prison. And now we turn to the A Better World page, where we read a column written by Jean Tetreault. The headline, Nonprofits Need to Redouble Efforts to Address Racism Across Society. Many nonprofit leaders, along with other businesses and community leaders, have made public statements recently about structural racism, especially in the wake of the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and in light of the impact of COVID-19 on communities of color. These expressions offer hope that we are at a crossroads. Such remarks, including my own, assert our commitment to work together to dismantle structural racism in our organizations. But these statements are not enough. As leaders, we can ensure we walk the talk by redoubling our organizational efforts to dismantle structural racism in our workplaces. Increasingly, executives in the nonprofit sector, working with business leaders, have taken steps that make their organizations more equitable, inclusive, and diverse. These actions are moving in the right direction, yet more needs to be done. The Building Movement Project, or BMP, a nonprofit that equips the nonprofit sector with research and resources to tackle social issues, documents the sector's racial leadership gap in its Race to Lead report. Studies have tracked a small percentage of people of color in executive director CEO roles for years, it shows, noting, efforts to support, train, and inspire aspiring leaders of color are important, but they are not enough to move the dial toward a more diverse and equitable leadership. Identifying and removing barriers to executive leadership among people of color can help change this narrative. The nonprofit sector can be a catalyst to continue the dialogue, model behaviors to dismantle racial barriers, and promote opportunity with people of color. Nonprofits engage the private business community and leverage their support to achieve a shared vision. Many business leaders volunteer for and serve on governing boards of nonprofits. The North Carolina Center for Nonprofits has initiated Walking the Talk programs, including webinars, discussion groups, and training on white privilege, structural racism, and the leadership gap described by BMP. Practical things we have done and encourage others to do include form a race equity committee on your board and among your staff and revise policies that may be biased. Evaluate personnel policies with an equity lens. Hire a consultant or seek a volunteer facilitator who specializes in race equity work to create a race equity strategy. And request executive search firms and others with whom you contract to share their diversity policies. In August, the center will offer Walking the Talk Part 2, Dismantling Racism in Our Sector, to help build the nonprofit leadership pipeline. This executive leadership program will focus on the racial leadership gap, the generational leadership gap, and the policies, practices, and organizational cultures in nonprofits that exacerbates these gaps. When we acknowledge that structural racism exists, we become more open to identifying strategies that model changing behaviors. Organizations and businesses intent on making change will support education and a willingness to learn, make mistakes, and keep going. Working together, black, brown, and white colleagues can transform our organizations and our sector. We cannot turn away from this opportunity. We can do this. Jean Tetreault is the president and CEO of North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. Plans reveal new future for shuttered Raleigh Hotel. And this article is written by Caleb Harshberger. After years of decay and dilapidation, the site of a long-abandoned hotel in Raleigh may soon see new life. Alliance Residential Company filed site plans earlier this month for Broadstone Oak City, calling for 328 new apartments across four multifamily buildings on the site of the Plaza Hotel in Northeast Raleigh. Last year, the company requested the property be rezoned to make way for new development. The property is situated on 13 acres at 2815 Capitol Boulevard along a commercial corridor near the Interstate 440 interchange with US 401. Filings with the city call for four multifamily buildings up to four stories tall, complete with apartments and a single-story fifth building for a total of 360,136 square feet of new development. The apartments include 246 one-bedroom units, 66 two-bedroom units, and 16 three-bedroom units. Planned amenities include a clubhouse, fitness center, and pool. Klein Design is the architect on the project. McAdams is providing planning, engineering, and landscape architect services. The site is made up of two parcels, the Plaza Hotel property and an undeveloped property behind it. That undeveloped parcel is owned by an LLC controlled by local businessman Dean Debnam. The Plaza Hotel property is owned by hotel investor Balbir Bill Brar of Fayetteville. Brar acquired it through an auction sale in 2011, paying $1.4 million for the 272-room hotel. At the time, Brar said he planned to renovate the rooms and reopen it as a hotel located at the intersection of Highwoods Boulevard. However, by 2014, Brar had yet to secure financing and decided to hire Raleigh commercial real estate broker Sanjay Mundra of Howard Perry and Walston Commercial to market the site. Mundra is intimately familiar with the hotel property as he and his family used to own the hotel in the 1990s. The hotel has now been closed for 18 years, and county records still list Brar as the owner. The hotel opened in 1981 and features nearly 127,284 square feet, according to real estate data firm Reonomy. And next in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a story written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. The headline, looking for a COVID-19 vaccine trial in Raleigh? Here's the number to text. Residents in the Triangle interested in being part of the first wave of patients tested with the new COVID-19 vaccine now have the opportunity, thanks to a clinical site open in Raleigh. This week, Triangle-based Wake Research, an integrated site network, announced the commencement of several COVID-19 trials across its sites, including the Phase 3 trial of the Moderna mRNA vaccine that has captured worldwide attention. The trial plans to enroll 30,000 people. According to the company, six of Wake Research's sites have been selected to participate in the Phase 3 trial for the vaccine candidate. Its Raleigh site, located at 3100 Durley Road, is the only site in the Triangle, other than UNC Chapel Hill's University Hospital site, that is participating in the trial. We are excited about the early round successful results leading to progression to the next phase of studies. The data looks good and promising, said Dr. Ella Grock, president and CEO of Wake Research. Company officials say exact information is not available regarding the trial, but hundreds will be enrolled at each site, including Raleigh. The window for people to enroll is a few weeks until the enrollment is full. Some patients enrolled in the trial will receive a placebo instead of the vaccine, though the company declined to say what the ratio would be. Volunteers will be expected to participate in the trial for 24 months, with a few in-person follow-ups and mostly phone calls during that period. Company officials said that if patients no longer wish to or can no longer participate, they can stop at any time. Wake Research confirmed that those selected for the trial will be compensated for their participation. Those interested in participating in the trials can text COVID to 919-276-8331 for information. Once again, those interested in participating in the trials can text COVID, COVID, to 919-276-8331 for information. In addition to receiving the highest quality of care from some of the best physicians in the clinical research field, participants in these studies are contributing to the future of medicine, providing key insights and data needed to help develop a treatment or vaccine for COVID-19, Kroc said in a prepared statement. Wake Research's trial, other locations include one in Fayetteville, as well as sites in Tennessee, California, Texas, and Nevada. According to a breakdown of the trial, other North Carolina locations include locations in Charlotte, Wilmington, and Winston-Salem. Moderna's experimental vaccine, known as mRNA-1293, produced, quote, a good immune response, unquote, and trial participants suffered no serious adverse events, according to results released Tuesday by Emory researchers and published at the same time by the New England Journal of Medicine. The drug is designed to induce neutralizing antibodies directed at a portion of the coronavirus spike protein, which the virus uses to bind to and enter human cells, according to Emory. The initial phase of the clinical trial studied the effects of the vaccine in three different doses, 25 micrograms, 100 micrograms, and 250 micrograms, on 45 individuals ages 18 to 55, said Dr. Nadine Raphael, contact principal investigator at the Emory Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit, VTEU. No serious adverse events were reported, investigators said. Side effects, including fatigue, headache, chills, myalgia, and pain at the injection site were reported by more than half of the volunteers, with systemic adverse events being more common following the second vaccination and in those who received the highest vaccine dose, they said. And our next article is written by Lauren Onasorge. The headline, businesses with pandemic insurance? Yes, it may happen, but won't be cheap. The calls are coming in, says Keith Pearsall, president of Business Insurers of North Carolina. Longtime customers are inquiring about business interruption claims, eager to make up for lost revenue as their bars and restaurants shuttered amid the global pandemic. And they're being told their claims just aren't covered. I feel for them, I really do, Pearsall said. Unfortunately, nobody has a good answer. BINC, like most insurers across the nation, has exclusions in their contracts expressly prohibiting claims from pandemics. It comes down to a contract, Pearsall said. They have a contract with a company, and the company they have a contract with is only going to respond if coverage is granted in that contract. And right now, there's little regulators can do, according to North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey. We can't ask insurers to do something that's not in their policies, he said. Causey predicts an answer will emerge from Washington. However, pandemic insurance, a way for companies to recoup future losses from government shutdowns. Right now, it just doesn't exist. There really is no coverage available on the market to small and medium-sized businesses that would allow them to get coverage for a pandemic, says Jay Bregman, CEO and founder of New York-based short-term insurance seller Thimble. Obviously, this coverage should exist. It's probably the biggest risk to small businesses that exist nowadays. But crafting pandemic insurance is a complicated process, said Stefan Holzberger, who oversees global ratings coverage for AM Best Rating Service, and it could turn the insurance industry on its head. The insurance industry on its own does not have the financial resources to handle a pandemic, and frankly, if they tried to price for that type of coverage, it would be so expensive businesses wouldn't be able to pay the premiums to cover those kinds of losses, he said. Holzberger said one option is a public-private partnership. He points to something similar to the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, where insurance companies could write a policy to cover lost revenue associated with a pandemic. A portion of the premiums collected would be fed to a federal program, and in exchange, the federal program would cover the majority of losses if a pandemic struck. I've heard 80, 85, 90% would be borne by the federal government, and the insurance industry would retain the loss that's not covered by the federal government, Holzberger said. But even a 5% to 20% retention could be catastrophic for the industry, he said. It could impair a number of insurance companies and render them insolvent, Holzberger said. And it could pack the biggest punch to local, smaller players operating in specific regions. If there were to be a pandemic that would hit their marketplace, they could find themselves in a lot of trouble from a solvency standpoint based on that risk concentration. The national and international players tend to be more diversified, he said. And knowing those risks, some companies could put themselves out of the market, unable to provide the coverage. It could then reduce the players in the market to only those largest global companies that have financial flexibility, Holzberger said. That's exactly what Pearsall fears for insurers in the Triangle. A tornado, he notes, might take out a neighborhood, but not every single one of his clients. This is something that took the whole country down, Pearsall said. I just don't see how they could price it. All say crafting a policy would be complex. Pandemics have hit the globe for generations, and yet the global reach of COVID-19 was something few could see coming. Even just drafting a policy would require a massive data crunch and the cooperation of big data players. Yuri Blackman is the founder and CEO of Gideon Informatics, an online medical publishing company dealing in such data. Its database tracks outbreaks going back to the Middle Ages, from Ebola to the plague. And it provides details aimed at making those types of events easier to forecast. Typically, the healthcare information it compiles is used in the healthcare field, but in the case of German reinsurer Munich Re, its data is key to the algorithms assessing risk for the pandemic product it rolled out in 2017 called Epidemic Risk Solutions. They are using our data to help figure out actuary probabilities, Blackman said. Right now, Munich Re is the only insurance customer crunching its numbers, but Blackman said that since the coronavirus headlines hit, he's seen queries increase, and he imagines companies like his will be providing the data used to calculate risks for insurers as pandemic policies are developed in the United States. The data is out there, he said. Developing a pandemic policy, even with the benefit of big data insights, takes time, however. The Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, for example, took more than a year after 9/11 to get President George W. Bush's signature, and not all small businesses have the benefit of time. But Bregman said that seeking to insure against the next wave, which could hit in a matter of months. Thimble is among those exploring private sector solutions, policies that could act as a patch on the current system, able to offer coverage immediately. It's hoping to one day offer a low-limit policy, probably up to, say, $5,000. This would be something that could be paid programmatically as soon as the shutdown occurred due to a pandemic, Bregman said. It's not computating for your true losses, but it's a payment to get you to the next phase, to tide you over. And this is a way that's not going to bankrupt the entire industry. Such a solution might be expensive, he admits. Like flood insurance, it would vary in price depending on where you are and where your area stands in terms of risk. Another option could be similar to catastrophic bonds, said Michael Edesis, adjunct associate professor with the Division of Environment and Sustainability at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Already used for earthquake and hurricane protection, they are essentially a kind of crowdfunded insurance, he said. Investors invest their money in the bonds and receive regular premiums, plus some interest on the funds on deposit, Edesis said. Should the pandemic occur before the bond matures, some funds are paid out to victims. The bonds might be issued by a government or its public health department, he said. As for Pearsall, he says the future is worrisome for regional insurers in North Carolina. Since we're staring this thing in the face right now with no end in sight, I don't see how the initial pandemic insurance rates would be affordable for most companies, he said. If I would have offered this coverage to my customers, I can't put words in their mouths, but I don't think I'd have too many takers. They'd look at me like I'm crazy, but here we are, and there are folks who say they'd buy it if they could. And as we are down to our last seconds of the program, we will stop there as we run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.